After months of speculation about what President Donald Trump would do about the Paris Climate Agreement, the decision has come down.
So we're getting out, but we will start to negotiate, and we will see if we can make a deal that's fair. And if we can, that's great. And if we can't, that's fine.
President Trump is pulling the U.S. out of the landmark climate agreement, signed by more than 190 countries in late 2015. Trump had been lobbied by everyone from Elon Musk to Rex Tillerson to, his daughter Ivanka Trump, to stay in the agreement. But in the end, he chose a path that has pleased the nationalist wing of his base and fulfilled one of his biggest campaign promises.
We don't want other leaders and other countries laughing at us anymore, and they won't be. They won't be. I was elected to represent the citizens of Pittsburgh, not Paris.
Welcome to Trump on Earth. I'm Reed Frazier. I'm podcasting today from Pittsburgh, not Paris. And this week, we're going to get into what the Paris Agreement means and what Trump's decision to leave it means for the U.S., the world, and the climate. That's when Trump on Earth continues.
Trump on Earth is produced by the Allegheny Front, a public media outlet in Pennsylvania that covers the environment. For more environmental news, go to AlleghenyFront.org.
And Point Park University's Environmental Journalism Program. More at pointpark.edu.
You can find all of our episodes on our website, TrumpOnEarth.org. Have a question? Email us at TrumpOnEarth@gmail.com.
For years, our guest this week has been watching the UN climate negotiations that led to the historic Paris Agreement. Ann Carlson is the Shirley Shapiro Professor of Environmental Law and the co-director of the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA's School of Law. Ann Carlson, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Okay, Ann, let's start with the basics. What is the Paris Agreement and what does it actually do?
The Paris Agreement is the second of two very important agreements that the global community has entered into to begin to tackle the problem of climate change. And what's especially interesting and unusual about the Paris Agreement is that it asks countries to make voluntary commitments to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions rather than having what we call top-down binding emissions limits that would actually be included in the treaty. So each country submits, they're called nationally determined contributions, saying, this is what we think we can do, this is what we're willing to do. It was really quite an historic achievement.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering, why was it such a big deal? Why was it so important?
Well, one of the reasons it's such a big deal is because climate change is a notoriously difficult problem to solve. Some people call it a super wicked problem. When greenhouse gas emissions get emitted into the atmosphere, they stay in the atmosphere for tens, 20s, even hundreds of years. So the problems of climate change that are occurring today are the result of emissions that have been going up into the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution. So we're asking people to solve a really long-term problem where we can't see immediate changes to the problem, and we have to change our behavior really fundamentally. The other problem is that anyone who uses any kind of fossil fuel, that is gasoline, coal-fired power plants, natural gas-fired power plants, is contributing to climate change. So it's the result of activity around the world. We all contribute to it, and therefore we all have to collectively agree to try to change our behavior. And that's a really hard thing to do.
And it's taken a long, long time to arrive at, 190 countries or so. Why was it so hard for so many years to get an agreement done?
So in addition to the problem itself being difficult, different countries have contributed to the problem in different ways. So the industrialized countries, think of Europe and Japan and the United States and Australia and Canada, have been contributing to the problem of climate change literally since the Industrial Revolution began. Countries like China and India, which are growing really rapidly, did not burn lots of fossil fuel until more recently, but they're now the biggest contributors to climate change. China in particular surpassed the United States several years ago. And so we really need countries that are developing, they're lifting literally millions of people out of poverty to change the way they fuel their economies. And that's a really hard thing to ask them to do when the developed countries already got to develop and already got to emit lots of greenhouse gases without having to change their behavior. So getting the countries of the world to decide who is going to reduce their emissions when you could point fingers at different countries to try to figure out who's to blame makes it really tough. And it's also what makes the Paris Agreement such an incredible achievement.
So it's like kind of we're almost at a head start in terms of our development as an economy in the United States versus other countries which are, behind us. So I want to ask you, what does it actually mean that the U.S. has pulled out of the agreement? Is there something that will happen because of it? Factories in the U.S. Can emit more pollution, or an automaker like GM can make bigger trucks that use more fuel and are just more polluting. What's the sort of upshot of this agreement now?
So kind of strangely, the upshot of the president's announcement last week that the United States is withdrawing from Paris doesn't actually change a thing in the immediate term. That's for two reasons. The first reason is that the U.S. actually can't withdraw from the Paris Agreement for about 2.5 years, and then it takes a year after that before we're formally withdrawn. So this is really just an announcement that we're going to withdraw sometime in the future. That's part of the terms of the treaty. But secondly, the United States submitted its commitment to reduce greenhouse gas emissions under the Obama administration. And part of that commitment was something called the Clean Power Plan, which gets existing electric utilities to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. And part of that plan also included reducing emissions from vehicles, including passenger cars. The Trump administration has already made clear that it is going to repeal the Clean Power Plan. And in addition, it's pretty clear that we're going to roll back some of the automobile standards. We're going to do that whether or not we're in Paris or not. That's been part of the president's environmental platform since he started campaigning. He's made that abundantly clear. So one of the strange things about last week's announcement is that in some ways it really didn't change anything except to make really clear what was already clear, which was that the United States was going to repudiate its commitment to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions. That's what's really significant.
You've written that it'd almost be better if the U.S. pulled out of the Paris Agreement rather than stay in with this sort of lackluster commitment or zero commitment to actually implementing its climate reductions by eliminating the Clean Power Plan, et cetera. Can you explain that a little bit? It's almost like better no effort than a half-baked effort.
So my argument is really a little bit different than that. The Trump administration has assaulted environmental regulations in every respect, and it's also already made really clear that it doesn't believe in engaging in international negotiations to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So, for example, the Trump budget slashes virtually all staff across federal agencies who work on climate change. The budget contemplates zero money going to the international negotiations that actually brought Paris into being. It proposes zero money for a fund to help developing countries adapt to climate change. And as I've already said, it eliminates the Clean Power Plan, it slashes the auto regulations and some other rules that were really important for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So in my view, repudiating Paris actually really isn't doing very much, except that it's telling the world what the world should already know, which is this is the singular biggest assault on environmental regulations we've ever seen out of a United States government. And so by making it clear that we're withdrawing from Paris, to me, that's just telling people you should understand what we're already doing, which is to repudiate climate change across the board in every way. And I think that may have the effect actually of galvanizing public opinion against the United States position, both internationally and domestically.
Are there any benefits to U.S. companies to pulling out of the agreement? I mean, a lot, just to back up a little bit, a lot of these companies, even ExxonMobil, some big coal companies, technology companies like Google, et cetera, were lobbying the president not to pull out. Maybe you can explain the impact on U.S. businesses. Why would these businesses want the Paris Climate Agreement to stay in? And are there any companies that are actually advantaged by pulling out?
So the biggest reason I think companies want the United States to stay in the Paris agreements is because they see the future of energy in the United States and around the world as being based on renewable energy sources like solar and wind, and automobiles being powered by the electricity grid, which would then be fueled by renewables, and essentially having a carbon-free future. That's actually a big business opportunity for a lot of businesses across the country and internationally, and I think many of them don't want to be left behind in the kind of future transition to a clean energy future. Again, though, pulling out of the Paris Agreement isn't actually what's significant in terms of substantive policy. That's the policies that we've already recounted, where Trump is rolling back the Clean Power Plan, rolling back automobile standards, etc. So the companies that stand to gain from the rollback of environmental regulations are those companies that actually engage in the dirtiest polluting activities. So coal is the biggest polluter that we have. It causes huge amounts of air pollution in addition to being a very, very potent emitter of greenhouse gas emissions. So to the degree that regulations actually are rolled back on the coal industry, we could see some increase in coal. But it's also important to note that coal is declining for lots of reasons that have nothing to do with government regulation. The biggest one is that the price of natural gas has actually dropped dramatically, and natural gas is being substituted for coal. Natural gas is actually a much cleaner fuel. The other place I think you're likely to see companies who are lobbying in favor, not so much of pulling out of the Paris Agreement, but for rolling back regulations, is in drilling and fracking on public lands and offshore oil exploration and so forth, because the Trump administration is also rolling back those regulations.
So the president and most of his anti-Paris Agreement lieutenants, people like EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt, they argued that this was a bad deal for the United States, that countries like China and India wouldn't have to do hardly anything for a few years. And he complained that the U.S. had to pay into something called the UN's Green Climate Fund for Developing Nations. That's money to help developing nations introduce cleaner forms of energy. And I'm going to just play a little cut from his speech announcing the U.S. withdrawal from the agreement.
For example, under the agreement, China will be able to increase these emissions by a staggering number of years, 13. They can do whatever they want for 13 years, not us. India makes its participation contingent on receiving billions and billions and billions of dollars in foreign aid from developed countries. There are many other examples. But the bottom line is that the Paris Accord is very unfair at the highest level to the United States.
So is President Trump right? Was this an unfair deal to the U.S.? Why don't China and India have to act as fast as the U.S.?
So this is not unfair to the U.S. in lots of different ways. Let me start again with the fact that this is a voluntary agreement. And in fact, Trump had already indicated that he was going to roll back the United States' commitment, which is allowed under the agreement. The agreement doesn't have any sanctions for doing that. And so the U.S., again, is doing voluntarily what it can to reduce its emissions. Of course, President Obama would have done significantly more than what President Trump is interested or willing to do. So that's the first point. The second point is the United States is the single biggest contributor to greenhouse gas emissions historically. If we hadn't emitted all those emissions, we wouldn't have a problem of climate change. And so, again, historically, we've contributed the most, and we're in a position with our economy where it's actually relatively easy for us to begin to cut our emissions pretty dramatically because we are developed, we have a lot of energy efficiency technology, it's been relatively easy to switch to things like solar and wind energy as opposed to coal and natural gas. So that's one point. Another point is that many of the emissions that the Chinese emit are actually the result of American consumers purchasing goods from China that are made with electricity and other sort forms of energy that are really carbon intensive. So many of the Chinese emissions are actually attributable to United States consumption of products that are made in China and then transmitted to the United States. Third, China actually has committed to a pretty big reduction in its own greenhouse gas emissions while it's trying to grow its economy, again, to lift millions of people out of poverty. So it is supposed to flatten its emissions by 2030 and committed to renewable energy sources of 20% by that year. It's already way ahead of that schedule and, in fact, is beginning to flatten its emissions already, which is great news for the planet and also is inconsistent with Trump's assertion that this is unfair. The Chinese are doing a lot. It's very hard for them to shift really dramatically to cleaner energy sources while still trying to maintain economic growth, and yet they're doing so. They're really switching rapidly to renewable sources. Finally, India. India announced today that it is going to ban non-electric cars by 2030. It is already repudiating a bunch of deals for coal-fired power plants and shifting to wind and solar. So it's actually also moving much faster than what it committed to under the Paris Agreement. That's partially because it's very possible to do this. It's possible to do it in a cost-effective way, and it also produces huge benefits to the people of India and to China to use cleaner sources of energy and reduce really stifling air pollution that those countries face.
Having said all this about, you know, sort of this deal, you know, pulling out doesn't really change all that much for American businesses, especially since the EPA is doing away with a lot of the climate regulations that Obama put in. Why pull out of the agreement? What's the upside here?
I don't think there is an upside. I think it's a bad move on the part of the Trump administration. I think the United States could have stayed in and continued to follow precisely the environmental policies that Pruitt and Trump have already announced. Staying in the Paris Accord keeps the United States at the diplomatic table. It signals to the rest of the global community that we actually believe that climate change is a problem worth both fighting about and discussing and having negotiations over. So basically, it's a very isolationist move. You know, there are a lot of theories about why the Trump administration is doing this that really have very little to do with climate change and have much more to do with either appealing to Trump's political base or basically snubbing the global community because Trump himself feels snubbed. I don't know what the motivation is, but I don't see a gain for the United States, except to galvanize public opinion to make clear that many, many people believe that we need to be doing a lot to tackle climate change and getting cities and states, as we've seen in the past few days, to step up their efforts in order to counter the quite draconian policies of the Trump administration.
So there's been a lot of hand-wringing since this announcement was made last week. But one thing that has gone underreported is that Trump could have done something far more drastic, which would be to pull out of the 1992 UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. And I know you've written about this, and I just wanted to get your take on that and maybe just explain what that agreement was and what it would have meant to pull out of that agreement for future climate negotiations.
Sure. So it's the treaty that you're referring to is known as the UNFCCC, and it was entered into in 1992 by something like 190 countries, and it basically set the framework for setting up annual climate negotiations, also for getting countries to report their greenhouse gas emissions, because before we can cut them, we need to know actually how many emissions are being emitted from different sources around the world. And it also set up funding mechanisms and so forth to figure out how we're going to pay for these negotiation efforts. This was a treaty that was entered into when George H.W. Bush was president. He signed it, and it was ratified by the United States Senate. Fast forward to the Paris Agreement. One of the things that's interesting about the Paris Agreement is that it was negotiated in a way that would not require Senate ratification, because the Obama administration understood that it could not get a two-thirds vote of the Senate. So if you withdraw from the Paris Agreement, assuming that we go through the formal procedures to do that, it's actually easy to get back into the agreement. You can just, the United States, the next president could just walk in the door and say, we want to be in the agreement, and they could do that in a formal way. If Trump had withdrawn from the UNFCCC, by contrast. That would have had to go back to the United States Senate for a vote. So we would have needed a two-thirds vote to get back into the whole climate process.
Trying to imagine the U.S. Senate agreeing with any, you know, kind of two-thirds majority on anything, let alone something involving climate change, seems almost impossible.
I think that's exactly right. So he took a less draconian path when he decided he was just going to withdraw. And again, he can't withdraw for another 3.5 years. So in a lot of ways, what he did was really just say, I don't like the Paris Agreement and we're not in it anymore, without actually formally taking any steps to get out of the agreement. If he'd done the UNFCCC route, that would have been a much more dramatic move.
And I want to ask you about this withdrawal procedure. It takes 3 years to withdraw from the agreement. It so happens that the U.S. withdraws the day after the next U.S. presidential election. So is there a chance that if Trump gets defeated and there's a more, you know, he gets defeated by a candidate who wants to re-enter the agreement, can the U.S. just hop right back in?
Yes, it can just hop right back in. All it has to do is basically deposit a notice with the international community saying we agree to be bound by the Paris Agreement, and then to submit a new United States commitment to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions.
Good to know. He famously said that he represents the city of Pittsburgh, not Paris, in telling people that that's why we're pulling out of the agreement. The mayor of Pittsburgh, of course, now famously has said, you know, we're going to actually abide by the agreement. We're going to reduce our emissions. There's been this huge upswell of support for reducing emissions from local governments, cities, and states. So what is this sort of sub-national level movement to do something about climate change? What can these cities and states actually accomplish?
So they can actually accomplish a lot, and particularly on the production of electricity side and on promoting energy efficiency, which are two really big and important steps in reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So most states have a lot of control over their electricity sector, and they can do things like mandate renewable energy, mandate the use of solar and wind energy. They can also get utilities to finance energy efficiency. So, for example, putting insulation in your attic so you're not wasting a bunch of energy. Cities can also do things like change out all of their traffic lights and use LED lights and save lots and lots of money and also reduce lots and lots of emissions. So if you get these subnational jurisdictions together, cities, states, etc., they can have a huge effect on the problem. They can also do things like purchase electric vehicle fleets. There's one area where they're going to have a tougher time, and that is states and cities, with the exception of the state of California, are not allowed to issue greenhouse gas standards for cars and trucks. That's really the purview of the federal government.
Right. So the California is trying to, you know, really ramp up its fuel efficiency standards. Is that right?
Well, right now, California's standards are in line with the federal standards. But EPA Administrator Pruitt and President Trump have indicated that they want to roll back some of those standards. If they do that, we're going to see a big battle between California and the federal government about whether California can go ahead with stronger standards, because California actually needs to get the permission of the federal government in order to do that.
So I guess my last question is, you know, this is always a question I have about when we're talking high-level, you know, regulations, laws, treaties. What impact will pulling out of the Paris Agreement have for people's everyday life? I mean, people sitting out there in America or other parts of the world, you know, what impact will it have?
Well, in the immediate term, you know, people probably won't feel very much. In the United States, in the longer term, we're really going to need to see, you know, how effective the cities and states that are going to step in and try to reduce their own greenhouse gas emissions are going to be. It might actually mobilize people in many respects, politically, to get their local governments and their state governments to act on climate change. Around the world, here's the biggest issue that I worry about. In the Paris Agreement, the United States provided a huge amount of the diplomatic leadership necessary to get China to the table, to get India to the table, to get the global community to agree to reduce emissions. Without U.S. leadership, I think there's a big fear that even though the Paris Agreement remains in place, and even though other countries have committed to continue to work to reduce their emissions, We really need to reduce our emissions much more dramatically than what the Paris Agreement has called for. And we need leadership for that. So without leadership from the United States, I think there's a big question about will we get on the path that we need to get on to avert the worst consequences of climate change. Those consequences will likely be felt over the course of the next 10, 20, 40, 50, even 100 years. So this is a long-term problem where, you know, people in the future could really suffer the consequences of the failure of the United States to act on this problem today.
Yeah, I was talking with a Trump supporter in Western Pennsylvania over the weekend, and I asked him pointedly about climate change. And, you know, when it came down to it, he said, you know, he was like 70 years old. He said, basically, you know, if it affects the children of my grandchildren, you know, that'll be on them to deal with. And I'm not going to be around then. So kind of like, what do I care?
Yeah, the problem is it's going to affect his children and his grandchildren. And, you know, I guess there's a big question. What obligation does the current generation owe to the next generation to leave the planet in the same shape that we were left the planet? And I think that's a pretty fundamental question, and maybe there's fundamental differences of opinion, but I think most people believe that we should not be handing off a planet to our children and our grandchildren that is in significantly worse shape than the planet that we were given by our ancestors.
Well, Anne Carlson, thanks so much for joining us and helping us sort out what's going on with this Paris Agreement. Thank you.
Sure. It was a pleasure to be on your show.
That's Anne Carlson. She's the Shirley Shapiro Professor of Environmental Law and the co-director of the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA's School of Law. You're listening to Trump on Earth.
By the way, it isn't just environmentalists who want us to remain a part of the Paris Accord. ExxonMobil lobbied for us to stay in it. Shell wanted us in it. Walmart supported it because apparently these big companies ran the numbers. And it turns out if climate change destroys human life on Earth, it could be bad for business.
That's our show. Trump on Earth is a co-production of the Allegheny Front. We're a public media outlet covering the environment in Pennsylvania. For more news on the environment, go to AlleghenyFront.org and Point Park University's Environmental Journalism Program. More at pointpark.edu. Our producer and digital editor is Andy Kubis. Thanks to Point Park graduate student Rebecca Lesner for her help. Kathy Naur is the executive producer. Don't forget to rate and review us on your favorite podcast app and tell a friend about us. All our episodes can be found at trumponearth.org. My name's Reed Frazier. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.